promise that we'll be out here before breakfast starts. I know when I'm going to lose the group. I shared with some of you at a study yesterday how I believe in signs and wonders. And I wanted to continue that. Yesterday I mentioned that when I came out at 6:35 for the second to go to breakfast, that there was a rainbow out there, and I, of course, took that personally, that God was speaking to me and affirming what I was going to be doing. And then at Matins, the person read the very scripture lesson that I was going to deal with here, and I took that personally as affirmation what's going to happen. Move right around.
Great, thank you.
Sure. And then last night at Vespers, they read the scripture lessons that I'm going to deal with this morning. And I ducked up and asked Jim Oinus right away, did you look and see that there was... No. He said, I didn't know you were going to do that. So I took it personally. We just have to keep working on it. So I'm going to do something that my dear friend Gertrude, I'm sure, has heard me do before. I've done a number of
times.
All right. And therefore, I'm not going to read the text again that you heard last night. Those were precisely the passages in Genesis 18 and 21 that I'm going to reflect on today. And I'm going to do that in terms of Frederick Buechner's handling of that story, which I think a lot of people have seen. This book goes way back, but it's still a good book, called Telling the Truth, The Gospel as Tragedy, Comedy, and Fairy Tale. And this is a section from comedy in that book. And I'm going to read a fair part of this and then and invite some response to you. Remember, the story is Sarah and Abraham, right? The place to start is with the woman laughing. She's an old woman, and after a lifetime in the desert, her face is cracked and rutted like a six-month drought. She hunches her shoulders around her ears and starts to shake. She squinties her eyes shut, and her laughter is all china teeth and wheeze and tears running down as she rocks back and forth in the kitchen chair. She's laughing because she is pushing 91 hard and has just been told she's going to have a baby. Even though it was an angel who told her she can't control herself, and her husband can't control himself either. He keeps a straight face a few seconds longer than she does, but he ends up cracking up too. Even the angel is not unaffected. The angel hides mouth behind the golden scapular, but you can still see his eyes. They are larkspur blue and brimming with something of which the laughter of the old woman and her husband is at best only a rough translation. The old woman's name is Sarah, of course, and the old man's name is Abraham. And they are laughing at the idea of a baby being born in the geriatric ward. and Medicare picking up the tab. They are laughing because the angel not only seems to believe it, but seems to expect them to believe it too. They're laughing because with part of themselves, they do believe it. They're laughing because with another part of themselves, they know it would take a fool to believe it. They're laughing because laughing is better than crying, and maybe not even all that different. They're laughing because if by some crazy chance it just should happen to come true, then they would really have something to laugh about. They're laughing at God and with God. And they are laughing at themselves, too, because laughter has that in common with weeping. No matter what the immediate occasion is of either your laughter or your tears, the object of both ends up being yourself and your own life. They had quite a life, this old pair. Years before, they had gotten off to a good start in Mesopotamia. They had a nice house in the suburbs, two-car garage, several color TVs, and a barbecue pit. They had a room all fixed up for when the babies started coming, with their health and each other and their families behind them. They had what is known as a future. Sarah got her clothes at Bonwitz, did volunteer work at the hospital, was a member of the League of Women Voters. Abraham was pulling down an excellent salary for a young man, plus generous fringe benefits and an enlightened retirement plan. And then they got religion, or religion got them. And Abraham was convinced that what God wanted them to do was pull up stakes and head out for Canaan, where God had promised that he would make Abraham the father of a great nation, which would in turn be a blessing to all nations. So that's what they did. And that's where the trouble starts. They put the house on the market, gave the color TVs to the hospital, got a good price for the crib and the bassinet because they'd never been used. And Abram wrote an eloquent letter of resignation to the president of the company and received an equally eloquent one in reply, assuring him that there would always be a job waiting for him if he ever changed his mind and came back. If he ever regained his senses and came back is what the president expressed it in his first draft. But he didn't think it was something that he thought religion was a good thing, like social security and regular exercise, but he didn't think it was something to go overboard about. But in his final draft, he settled for the milder wording. So off they went in their station wagon with a U-Haul behind them and a handful of friends and relations, who, if they didn't share Abraham's religious convictions, decided to hitch their wagon to his star anyway. And among the people they took was their brother-in-law, Lot, and that turned out to be a bad mistake. The Yiddish word, I love Yiddish word, I wish I knew more about Yiddish. The Yiddish word, shlemiel, has been translated as the kind of person who's always going around spilling soup on people. And a shlemazel is the kind of person he's always spilling it on. And by that definition, Abraham was a schlamazel. The first thing that went wrong with their journey took place with the Egyptian pharaoh, who was struck by Sarah's beauty and made a serious play for her. Abraham, fearing that if Pharaoh discovered she was a married woman, he might decide to get rid of her husband, advised her to say she was his sister instead of his wife and let the chips fall where they may. This led to a complicated domestic situation, which almost cost Abraham the woman who was to be the mother of the great nation, and from which he was finally able to extricate himself only by admitting he'd lied, and thereby sustaining a considerable loss both of face and credibility. The next thing that went wrong took place when they finally limped into the promised land, and a nasty situation developed between Abraham and his in-laws. Lot and his crowd claimed the place wasn't big enough for both of them, and Abraham's crowd said they couldn't agree more. So as a way out of the impasse, Abraham proposed that they divide the land in two and each take half. He then made the mistake of telling Lot that he could have first choice. And of course, Lot chose the half that was fertile pasture land around the Jordan River, and Abraham was left with the disaster area known as Dead Man's Gulch. In other words, all of Canaan was the promised land, but some parts were more promising than others. Next thing was the worst. Chosen by God himself to be the prospective father of a great nation, Abraham made the discovery that he didn't stand a chance of becoming the father of anything, because after extensive medical examinations, all the leading authorities agreed Sarah was as barren as most of the real estate Lot had stuck. So the years rolled by like empty perambulators until finally, when Abraham was 100 and Sarah was 90, the angel arrived to make his shattering announcement. He said that when God made a promise, he stuck to it. Sarah was going to have a boy. And then they laughed. One account says that Abraham laughed until he fell on his face. And the other account says that Sarah was the one who did it. She was hiding behind the door of their tent when the angel spoke, and it was her laughter that got them all going. According to Genesis, God intervened then and asked about Sarah's laughter. And Sarah was scared stiff and denied the whole thing. And then God, no, You did laugh. And of course, God was right. Maybe the most interesting part of this whole story is that far from getting angry at them for laughing, God told them that when the baby was born, God wanted them to name him Isaac, which in Hebrew means laughter. So you can say that God not only tolerated their laughter, but blessed it, and in a sense joined in it, which makes it very special laughter indeed. God and humanity laughing together, sharing a glorious joke in which both of them are involved. It is perhaps as important to look closely into the laughter of Sarah and Abraham as it is important to look closely into the tears of Jesus Christ. Here's Bichner's story. All kinds of laughter, you know, of course. Not a lot of it in scriptures. It's often contrasted with weeping. There'll be a time when your weeping will stop and laughter will start. There's derisive laughter, often, by the way, by God, who laughs at human efforts to mess up what God has tried to put together. And there's laughter that is just sparkling ways of the way things happen and events take place. What I'm talking about in this morning hour isn't so much jokes and telling jokes as searching for and perceiving the comic, the stuff that is humorous about everything that is going on, and including the gospel, which we were certainly talking about yesterday, that it's downright odd, funny, I use the word weird, that God keeps taking us back. That the gospel is that assurance that no matter how we mess up, God is still there. We are deficient in not having a video, obviously, of Jesus. Because so much would be in the look on his face when he said some things. When he said to the woman, "Go and sin no more." I'm not sure what his face looked like when he said that. He knew human beings, for sure. He knew himself, the scriptures tell us. Or the famous parable of the prodigal son, or really the loving father. No, that's a weird story, you know. The son wants to come back, not because he's really had so much trouble with his dad and let him down. He went three square meals. Scripture says, "I got food back there. What's with me? Let's go where the food is." And then he rehearses, you know. Let's see, how do I say this? "Father, I've sinned against you, and you know, I want to just come back, and I don't want to be your son," and all that. And gets this all worked out, what he's going to say. Before he can get the words out, his dad's running down the path, throwing his arms around him, giving him a chance to say it. And finally, when he does say it, his dad isn't listening. He says, get the stuff out. We're having a party." That's weird. That's weird. And of course, we're very serious about it. We are. Most of the time, we're more serious than God. Or we certainly have pictured God with a terrible, serious look on his face. A terrible, serious attitude towards it all. And God not only is capable of laughter, but makes us capable of laughing at our seriousness. You know, all the stuff that we do. How serious we are about time. You notice I already said that we're going to be done on time. Everybody, we're talking. There's a few people here to get along with. I tried that. I can't do it. I can't get along without my watch here. know, we're pre-everything, pre-nuptial, you know, pre-childbirth, preschool, pre-college, pre-training, pre-aging, pre-retirement. You know. We never arrive. We never get to where. It's always pre somewhere. It's really, we're a funny lot. Or our possessions, you know, how we get that stuff around us. I love the Lily Tomlin story, where she talks about going to the store to buy a wastebasket. And she pays for the wastebasket, and they put the wastebasket in a bag. She takes it home. Yeah. Takes it out of the bag, crumples up the bag, and throws it in the wastebasket. I think that's horribly funny. you know, we judge people. Who is that that said that? The neat thing about holiness, you don't know what kind of car people came in. Because we judge people about the car. And we start listening to the guy with the Mercedes, and we don't listen to the guy with the about his puddle jumper or whatever it may be, knowing that the possessions always add to the burden. Nobody's watching our house in Tacoma. Nope, it's all right. You know, but didn't have a house, we wouldn't have to worry about that. But we do have a house, and so we worry about that. And so our possessions, you know, possess us, of course. And knowledge, we want to know everything. Somebody with a PhD, and I don't know. I know many PhDs who are some of the dumbest people I've ever met. But if you have a PhD, you know, oh my. And we want to know so much, as if we can figure everything out. And then along comes this comic who says, little children understand it. You may miss it, but little children understand it. You've got to be in their mode of receiving things and seeing through things the way they do. I tell the story of my granddaughter Amanda when she was in kindergarten. Comes home and her mom says, well, how was kindergarten today? And she says, chaos. I think she was right. I don't know who explained that to her. She may have heard it from her sister. I don't know, but she... That was a one-word answer. Takes care of it. No need for a PhD. See through what's going on. Even in the seriousness of life, I spent some holy time with my sister-in-law, Lori, who is in a restricted unit for Alzheimer's, and I enjoyed being with her. I get, you know, she's my kind of people, because she makes sense. You know, I ask her if, you know, do you have any cousins that can come visit you, you know, and spend some time with you? And she said, not of that type. I've used that line now for a lot of things. Yeah. You know. Doesn't make any sense, but not at that time. It's okay. Or I said, you know, was the food? Is the food good? You don't like the food? And she said, just wait a moment. She said, well, that's what they say. It makes sense to me. Her poor son, of course, he tries to help make sense out of all of this because of that attachment. I just enjoy that conversation. It's my kind of people. Don't know what's really going on. When my first wife died, and we were almost all of us able to be with her for the 9 weeks between she came home and she died, we laughed as much as we cried. We laughed at so much. Early on, she had to run and get back in bed because relatives were coming. They thought she was dying and she ought to be in bed. That enabling of us to see the comic aspect of what is going on, is what we ought to be known for. Surely there are serious things in life. Surely Jesus told us heavenly, serious things, but often with a twist that enables us to laugh in the face of it. What better evangelism campaign than a congregation that understands laughter? That when the pastor goofs up in the liturgy, knows how to make that part of all that's happening and laughs at himself or herself, and it's just brings that message to the world. I'm not good at jokes, and I'm really not talking that much about that, but somebody said in the earlier session, he goes by Sears having this big sale and all of the washing machines there, all in a row. And one of them with the arrow that says, this side up, has got it down. He says, I just stood there and laughed. The whole darn thing was lined up and one was upside down. There's craziness all around. And if, as the scriptures tell us, God can make a Leviathan, some kind of huge fish, just for the sport of it, well, we ought to be able to be in the business of doing stuff just for the sport of it. It ought to be part of our vocation. Inside of our vocation, we don't have to be the joke-telling person, but we can be the person who sees the humor of what is about us, and with the courage, if you will, to be able to laugh, even at the wrong times. Even at the wrong time. Somebody in the last session pointed out to me the wisdom of the miners last week. Have you seen this stuff? It was up on the kiosk. The Junior Apocrypha that was written by the kids here last week. Let me read some of them. They were doing out of Proverbs in the King James Version, so the language will pick up. If someone's in your way, then goeth around. A tree's branches reach out. Why shouldn't you? Follow the trail that God shows you, or be like the river, wild. A person who tries something new shall thrive. A person who doesn't shall perish. If you are nice to a person, they will be back to you. If you are not, you won't have so many friends. Where there are no trees, there won't be any wood. So goeth to the woods to build houses. Spinach squares at Holden are like hair in your throat. If the rains cease to fall, the river will be silent. How's that? The child who jumpeth not in the lake remains warm. Oh, here's a lovely. A coin for the snack bar is better than a plate of millet fiesta.
I was here that day.
Those of us who have been a holding along know Millet Fiesta very well. You can't reason with a fool. If you swear, you will catch no fish. A room without a child does not need to be cleaned. A gang member who tags a fence is nervous even when not caught. But middle school students are as confident as a grizzly. Truth speaketh. Even a tree that falls is held up if it has many branches. Ooh. Look at that one. Like a polluted river or a sewage pond is a person who gives in when peers encourage smoking. And you can add your other verbs. Garbage not separated has been thrown away by a fool. Candy stolen from the store is sweet to the thief, but afterward his mouth will be full of tailings. Talk about suited to the place, huh? Well, this one I don't understand. The donkey's honks of hunger are louder than the armadillos of despair. But knowing how to spell armadillos, you know. Of course, they probably did it on spell check, you know. A glacier in the eye of a fool is better than tailings in the mouth of the wise. And the last one, spare the coffee, spoil the break. The little ones shall lead us in our understanding of it. There are so many sources for smiles and laughter. Surely, I think, our understanding of God's love for us, the gospel, which is all smiles. I don't mean just niceness, but that God just won't give in and let us go, loves us too much. We believe sent Jesus Christ to assure us of that, so that as Christ became human, we are enabled to become divine in Christ. And real humanity, we believe, started when that transfer is taking place. I don't mean only at the time of his birth, but in all of creation, coming to what God had intended. What Jesus went around talking about as the kingdom of God, the rule of God, the way of God, that things can be God's way better, that laughter is not only possible, but essential to every moment of life. There are difficulties with that, of course. But unless it is part of us, it just won't work. I remember, I don't know why I just thought of it, my dad dodging bodies jumping from buildings in downtown Chicago in 1929 at the stock market crash. Literally dodging bodies of people committing suicide. Now, nobody stands and laughs at that moment. But unless there is the possibility also yet of laughter, to laugh at death, to laugh at failure, and tomorrow I'm going to spend some more time on how essential failure is to human existence, how essential it is to life. Unless the possibility is there of laughing also at that, then there's little hope. Yeah. Little hope. But that's why we ought to be signals and signs of the ability to see the humor, the comic of life. This place gives us that opportunity by seeing the marvels of the mountains and the flowers and the animals and where do you get your smiles from, remembering what? The older we get, the more we depend on those memories of good stuff. The things that people told me about my birth, I like to smile at those. I was around but didn't remember much. But graduation, which I thought was one of the funniest things that happened to me in life, because I
don't think I learned anything.
Here I am graduating.
I don't know what that means. Or the birth of a child. Or the memory even of my dear daughter who died. This morning I could hear her say, "See you, Dad." And crying, which is happening now, is not very much different from laughing. So, where are your sources of laughter and crying, if you will?
I'll share a little laughter.
Sure.
We had a retirement seminar that I'm looking as a teacher about 3 years up the road, and we go to these things. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about your health insurance, your pediatrics. Mm-hmm. And we said, "Whoa, wait a minute, what are you talking about?" Well, this fellow retired about 58, his wife was middle 40s, mm-hmm. and they had a child. I don't know if you ever have a story, but the importance in retirement of having pediatric insurance.
That's great.
It brought the thing down, but still.
Yeah, that's deep. Somebody else?
The workplace. We take ourselves extremely seriously at work, and we need to laugh at ourselves. So one of the mottos is that we must have fun. And once that becomes part of the ethic of the work group, the work flows much smoother. You put things in much better perspective, especially when things go wrong. You can see the humor, and we've had some very humorous things happen in the test organization. It's delightful when you can laugh at yourself, knowing full well that you're taking the situation very seriously. Because you've got a problem on your hands, and you must work it.
Humor is not trivial, not at all. And that's again why we say the Jewish people often are humorists, comics and whatever's can often see something because they are serious about it and need, they believe, of course, I think, they believe they need to laugh at themselves as well as
Halloween is an interesting holiday because it kind of reveals sides of us hidden. I remember living in Washington, D.C. for a year. Everyone is, in that kind of community, is gone during the day. You really don't get any sense of community except when there's a snowstorm and no one can move. People come out of their houses like rabbits out of warrens. But also at Halloween, suddenly you are in their homes and you're sitting in costume and you're wandering around the neighborhood. And the next day all of that. But that magic moment, you see a glimpse that there's this sort of a puckishness.
I personally experience that. I go to D.C. for Halloween every year with my grandchildren. it's hours. We go out, go around, hours. Well, I fade out, they keep going. Poor parents have to keep going with them. It goes on and on. It's a really unique thing.
I was going to say that comic strips are a source of humor. I don't read the paper that much. I read the Bridge column and I read the comics. As much info on the comics as I can tell the rest. In the workplace, the professional workplace, Gary Larson, until he retired, was the premier one that got split up. And I created a wall in front of my cube at work of Neanderthal technology transfer.
Great.
Yeah, things haven't changed in 100,000 years. We still do the same thing. Now that he's retired, it's now Dilbert is the cartoon that's put up in the. I find that it all applies, and when I make a presentation, I like to start the presentation off with some apropos comic strip in it, and it's like, this is, in a great part.
Yeah.
And it helps. It's so true. The thing about this humor is it's not, you know, a joke.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yes.
It helps us laugh at ourselves, saying, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you say laughing and crying, you almost cry because it is so, you know,
sure.
You know, like one of the cartoons returns to his boss and says, "Are we doomed?"
Sure.
I think we're...
Well, his book, Telling the Truth, Gospel as Comedy, Truth and Comedy and Fairy Tale, he puts them all together. Yeah, good insight. And David Barry, I'm of course a fan of David. Yeah.
A couple of things, I guess, that come to my mind. Usually what I find, that the humor is always so closely related to the pain.
Mm-hmm.
And that as we struggle with issues, that that somehow the depth of our feeling, like you're talking about the death of your wife, the things that hurt us the most are also the things that give us the most joy when we look for those things. And in like manner, issues around parenting, that oftentimes we take so seriously the job of disciplining or controlling our children, and that bringing humor into that place is probably one of the most powerful parenting techniques to be able to diffuse tense situations and learning from our children, because they're masters, or the people that really know how to divert parents by making it a little bit more humorous. I had a daughter that was a champion.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Yeah, I think kids at age 3 know everything that a psychiatrist goes to school for. Yes.
I think that one of the things about laughter is that it's always involved with an element of surprise.
Mm-hmm.
That you cannot laugh at something unless you have been surprised.
Right. Yeah.
And the thing about surprise is that there's a crossroads that you come to when you come to surprise. Mm-hmm. And that crossroad either leads to laughter or to fear.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who are so afraid that surprise is always threatening and is always fearful, and
sure,
then they never laugh. But there are also people who know everything, or at least who think they know everything.
Mm-hmm.
And for those people, the possibility of laughter has disappeared, because there is no longer the element of surprise.
Yeah.
And without surprise, there is not laughter. And so I think it's always important for us to remember that to be open to the future is to be open to surprise, and therefore to be open to laughter.
Mm-hmm. Without question. Charlie Chaplin understood that. Pratfalls for little kids are surprised only later on. They see that it might be that their legs aren't working anymore, but they still see the surprise of the ball. That's a big part of it. And that's why the surprise of the gospel is something we really have to work at letting happen again and again, so that we can't engineer it and all of that, but being open to that possibility and seeing our calling, our vocation, as being people called to laugh at the whole serious business, as you say, of parenting or whatever else it may be. There is that element of it all the time. Robert Fulton, my daughter comes to work for Robert. And they just put a book together last week again. But his story about some of you I know have read the rites of passage. I don't know if I can even tell this one. The one about the wedding, the mother of the bride, huh? M-O-T-B. M-O-T-B. It's all about M-O-T-B. Who has this absolute perfect wedding that she is putting together for her daughter, around her daughter, above her daughter, whatever, you know, and it's all going to work just right. And Q, and everything else. And of course, as the bride and her father are waiting, they're walking back and forth near the food, and they start nibbling. And the father breaks open some of the champagne. She starts drinking, waiting, because they had to be ready, you know, just the right time. And the mother walks up, Q gives, and as she goes down the aisle, she gets greener and greener. And just gets right next to the mother. This is Fulgham's own experience. He was the minister. And he says, I mean throw up. He says, I don't mean vomit. I mean throw up. Because she hit the mother. She hit the groom. She hit the minister. She hit the whole thing. And of course, that all had to be done over. And the people were excused and came back, you know, an hour later or whatever. And the thing went on. And he asked permission of these people to tell this story and all that. And the punchline for me was, he said that he could never forget that just at the moment when the daughter threw up, that he saw this slightest smile on the face of her father. Great story. Great story. Oh my. Someone else.
Oh, I went to a wedding like that where it was a comedy of errors, and finally it was a recessional, and everybody thought, okay, this is the end, you know.
Yeah.
The organist started playing the recessional. All of a sudden, the organ stopped, and everybody turned around and looked. The American flag had blown into the candle, and we started.
Now that's against the law. Oh, dear. Anyone else?
I think maybe out of all of us, too, you see that we go through all these exercises of seriousness, and in the end, we look back and we laugh at them.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Our wedding, the perfect wedding, I was completely dressed, except I couldn't find any socks. The kids had all taken my black socks. I put white socks on. But that turned out, but those things of life, those tragedies even, that we can go back and laugh at, I guess that we need to look at that. I guess finally in my 50s now, I've done a lot of things that mm-hmm. I thought were very, very serious. Mm-hmm. You can almost get sick over if you don't laugh.
Yeah, yeah, for sure, for sure. Yeah, my dad was a funny man, and he died when I was 17, and I inherited some of his genes that I'm terribly, terribly grateful for. And the few things that I know about for his life of humor, I treasure that gift of passing on. And that hopefully ought to be some of the things we pass on to one another. I've got a closing story because we're going to watch time. And it's not really funny, laugh funny, but it does deal with the humor of God giving us a way out of our dilemmas of age or forgetfulness or whatever it may be. It's a Jewish story. When the great Rabbi Baal Shem Tov felt that his people were threatened, he would go to a secret part of the forest to meditate. And there he would light a special fire, say a special prayer, and the disaster would be averted. And when his successor faced similar circumstances, he would go to the same place in the forest and pray, great master of the universe, I do not know how to light the special fire, but I'm able to say the special prayer. And this must be sufficient. It was, and the disaster was averted. And when his successor faced difficult times, he would go to the special place in the forest on behalf of his Jewish people and pray, great master of the universe, I do not know how to light the fire, I do not know how to say the prayer, but I know the place, and this must be sufficient. And it was sufficient, and the disaster was once again averted. And when it fell to his successor to deal with the misfortune of his people, he sat in his armchair with palms uplifted. Great master of the universe, he prayed, I am unable to light the special fire. I do not know the prayer. I cannot even find the place in the forest. But I can tell the story, and this must be sufficient. And it was. And we are people called to tell the story of God's love and presence
and power and laughter. Go have a laughable day.